today, let's get the date straight. Yesterday, someone argued with me about the date. That was funny. Remember, Vic, you know what I'm talking about? Remember yesterday? May 4th, 2015, Monday morning, a beautiful Monday morning in Jerusalem, but a sad Monday morning. And it's a small country. I want to dedicate this year in memory of the young man whose body perhaps will be brought back today, or Asaraf, who's kol hakavod to our search teams that found the body, killed in Nepal and all that happened there. And you wonder, or Asaraf to you is just a name. He was in one of my grandson's units. They were together, basic, know each other intimately, fought together. Or was injured last summer in battle. That was with not my grandson who was injured. This was with another grandson who he grew up with in the army. And then Lo Aleinu, my grandson should only live and be well, is married. He didn't go chutz laretz. He got married when as he approached the end of the army. And his friend went to breathe a little, as these kids need to let off steam. And Lo Aleinu, so I want to dedicate the shir in his memory. Now, we spoke last week about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We spoke about the wedding, and really there were two weddings. There were two weddings. It's the wedding in Warsaw, which was the state of the art, where the sixth Rebbe, and you can't blame him, Atzich Barim, I don't know how to say that in English, but let it stand over in Yiddish. How would you say that in English? Atzich Barim, he was so happy, so to have a son-in-law. I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik's sister-in-law, Rav Shmuel's wife, Batsheva Ziv Soloveitchik den Hutna. She was an Isha Gedola, if you knew her. Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha. So she, I remember when she, after, when she remarried following Rav Shmuel's death, so we're from the original people who bought into Berlin, to Rav Chaim Berlin 18. So Rav Hutner, Rav Yoshua Hutner, and Batsheva were my neighbors, one floor below us. We were very, very close. So, we were very close. I have to tell you, Batsheva, when Malka and I got married, Batsheva and Rav Shmuel made a Sheva brachas for us. So that gives you an idea of the relationship. So she would let her hair down with us, and she said to me that for my brother-in-law, the Rav, a son-in-law like Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein had for em gepasht. This was a son-in-law he dreamt about. You understand? I mean, Rabbi Aaron was Rabbi Aaron. And I always say, when people say he's the Rav's son-in-law first, it's not right. You have to talk about Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein as Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. Afterwards, you can mention he's the Rav's son-in-law, because he would have been Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein with or without being the Rav's son-in-law. But this was like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was boasting a son-in-law like he got. Who could dream, who could achieve? So you had the luxurious, flamboyant, extravagant, beautiful wedding in Warsaw. And you had the celebration in Russia with tears. And nevertheless, a few hundred chassidim got together, a few hundred people who still had a zikah, still had that Yiddish neshama, still had the connection, and they celebrated the wedding. Now, I want to devote the first part of today's shiur of the Rebbe's relationship with his wife. And I consider what Rabbi Steinsaltz wrote here the most insightful that Rabbi has ever written. Also, I have to tell you, I'm not dependent upon Rabbi Steinsaltz for the facts. Here, my periscope into Chabad gave me the same facts. The beauty of Rabbatin is how he interprets it, how he describes it. But I can tell you, via Tzvi Groner, Professor Groner, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, and by the way, if you know the Taboris from Beit Shemesh, Himmelstein, she's a Tabori. So you should know, her brother did a chesed shalemet of the highest order. When Tzvi died, he left an unfinished manuscript based upon his master's thesis, not his doctorate. His master's thesis was on brachot shenishtachku. It's on brachot that people made years ago that we no longer make. And Yosef Tabori from Bar Ilan, the eldest of the four Tabori children, the three boys and a girl, Judy, I think, is number two. I think it's Yosef, Judy, and then Binyamin, and then Ephraim, if my memory is correct from my childhood. But Yosef put out the volume, edited it, Li'acham Moto, and it's the finest gift you could have done, because at least the Sefer remains from Tzvi Grona. Articles you have here, there, if you don't collect them, they're lost. But this is a Sefer on Brachot Shenishtakhu. And Tzvi's assessment of the Rebbe and his wife, and these were his cousins, it parallels exactly what Rav Steinholz has to say. Now, the source is My Rebbe, by Adn Ibn Israel Steinsaltz. I told you he hebraized the name to Ibn Yisrael. I've been told that the Rebbe advised him to do that. And beginning on page 163, he has chapter 13 in this book. And by the way, Adn Steinsaltz wrote it in English, and the English, I don't want to talk about you, but it's certainly a higher level of English than I'm capable of writing. Chapter 13, The Rebbe's Loneliness. Now here, you're coming into a very fascinating topic. Why? Because go across the board. The Rav, what is the video, the documentary that I was privileged to bring into the world? What is it called? The Lonely Man of Faith. And you know that the theme of the loneliness is stressed there. I'm a team player. I'm different than a lot of other people I know who insist everything has to be their way. When I finally settled upon the producer, I withdrew to the side because I didn't want to hamper him. It's his movie, it's his film, his interpretation. Obviously, he called me whenever he could, and the only time there's a real mistake in the film is when he couldn't reach me and he asked someone in the States and they misinformed him, and that someone remains with that mistake until today. I corrected him, Tova corrected him, other people corrected him, and Ahal Pazich. That no, we're all wrong, and he has it right. So that's the only mistake, and he couldn't reach me that day. He left things for the last minute, which is no good either. So when the film was finished, I had two complaints that I brought up, and one of them I discussed with Atara, the whole question of mixed education with the Lapachila, but the evidence not for now. It's a discussion unto itself, an interesting discussion. But the loneliness, I thought, was overstressed. So he told me that Ein Hachinami, a lot of people have complained to him that it was overstressed. But Abe Levovitz, who knew the Rav better than anyone else in the Boston community and put up $1 million for the documentary, Abe had this catch on the Rav too, the loneliness. And the truth of the matter is, that you see, and I say this in the film. If you'll see it, you'll see it again. You'll understand what I'm saying. I say this there, and I say it now. People like the Rav, like the Rebbe, they are lonely because they are so different. They are so much above the average human being. Who can they relate to? Who can they be buddies with? And the more they're involved in their life, you take someone like Rabbanu Lichtenstein, and you read all the Hespedim. All the Hespedim essentially say the same thing. What was amazing here Monday night, if you paid attention, a guy named Rakefet speaks first. Fine, all right, Rakefet knew the Rav longer than anyone, and he, you know, what I did already with by Mari Chazal, with stories. It was, what I did was, again, it was minimal to what I prepared. I was in a time fix, because I can't be a hog, pardon the pun. But in Stamford, Connecticut, I'm going to give in detail what I left out and redo it properly, and it'll go on the YU website, Bezrat Hashem. It's arranged already. But I described Rav Aaron, okay? And one of the points I made is that Rav Aaron lived Shir HaShirim, Mishlei Kohelet, together. There were never periods in his life. He always was the same Rav Aaron. So if you notice, the three speakers that came after him, I told this to David Miller, I call your attention to it. These three speakers, all with Talmidim Rav Aaron. They didn't know him the way I knew him. I know him as a Talmud Chaver. Don't say I'm his buddy friend, but I was a buddy friend. I'm a Talmud Chaver. The others were Talmidim, but at three different periods. David was the 60s into the 70s, Asaf, Rabbi Betnash, the 80s into the 90s, and the medical doctor from your community, Alan Jatkowitz, is basically the 2000s. Now, their description, three different Talmidim, each one said what the other one said, exactly the same. Was the same Rebaran, the Gon, the Tzaddik, the Baal Chesed, and someone who lives like that, who doesn't go through periods in life, he has to be lonely by definition, because he's a different type of human being. And the Rav in the Lonely Man of Faith, and in this chapter on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you get the exact same description, that these were people who were dressed thousands. You went to the Rav's Yahrzeit Shir, we'll take my time, when Orthodoxy wasn't that big. Every seat in Lampert was filled. Every seat, the little section upstairs in Lampert, if you recall, the auditorium was filled. Standing room and back. I'm not talking what happens later where they transmit it via closed circuit TV to the Beis Medrash and across the street to Reuben Hall, to Morgenstern, wherever they transmitted it to. But here's a man getting up and speaking, surrounded by thousands. When he finishes the shiur, hundreds are going to come over to him and give him a yasher koyach, and yet he's a very lonely individual. Now, transfer that to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Here's the Lubavitcher Rebbe, a man who is addressing, if you ever were to Fabreng in Yutet Kislev, all right? Do you know Lubavitcher? Have you been to Lubavitcher? Retechim Veltarein. Again, I don't know how to say that in English. Have you been to Lubavitch? They knocked together a few houses. So you take the basement, basically. They knocked it together. So I don't know if it's as big as Lampert Auditorium, but I think you did get the 2,000 people into there. Then there was the flock outside and the loudspeakers. We'll forget about already the telephone hookups in the 1970s all over the world. We'll forget about already KBTV in the 1980s all over the world. I mean, I remember going into Binyanei Huma 3 o'clock at night, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Every street, every seat filled. On the screen in front of me, there's the Rebbe clear as daylight, beginning the Fabrengen in 7:70, 10 o'clock at night. And I told you, I was the only one there without earphones. I couldn't believe it. I look around, thousands of people with earphones. This one a Hebrew translation, this one English translation. I was one of the few Mohegans who understood the Rebbe in his own language that he was speaking. But then now, you ask, the Rebbe lonely, surrounded by thousands. He finishes in the morning, he's mobbed, everyone jumps on him. And yet, he's a very lonely individual. Now, of course, with that in mind, how does he relate to his wife? How do you forge a relationship? Marriage, they're newlyweds in the class, are all nuts. Not such a newlywed anymore, Rafi, as I understand the situation. Approaching fatherhood, it's a big change in life. It's from until now you've been an eved to your wife. With fatherhood, you become an eved nirtza. It's a lifetime experience. And don't forget it and accept it in dignity and pride. Understand? I don't want to go any deeper, but I know what I'm saying. So, how can he forge a relationship with his wife? Okay, now, I'm going to cite the Rav Adin Steinfeld's practically word for word. The Rebbe, because this is Rav Adin Steinfeld. You don't have to say Rakefer, although I have to say I had this feeling before. The Rebbe was an exceedingly lonely person. That was my perception of him, at least. When a person hardly speaks or writes about himself, and the Rebbe was such a person, there's no way to know for certain how he himself feels. He spoke in public for over 50 years, yet the number of times he referred to himself as an individual in any meaningful sense was minuscule. And even then, it was never about his emotions. Yeah, this is true. If you have the Rav, by the way, on this level was very different. Of course, when the Rav was just the opposite. It was amazing. The Rav was a very private person. You could see that he couldn't wait to get back on the plane to Boston, to go back to his native habitat where he felt at home, where he had his family. He was. You could feel. In New York, there was a bit of a screen around him. On the other hand, and the Rav said this himself, the Rav said, I'll quote him, I'm quoting him out of context for you to really understand, you have to hear a 2-hour shiur from the Rav, but the Rav said, when I get on the plane and he closes his doors for takeoff, I relax, he says. New York is a place like a jungle. All types of wild animals, I'm quoting the Rav. But when I get back to Boston, he says, I'm home. It's very insightful. But the Rav in public, this was what was amazing about him. He could let his hair down with the most intimate details of life. His relationship with his father, how he never got a kiss. His relationship with his wife. The death of his wife, the Torah that fell, if you recall, if you're familiar with Rakefet's work, the Rav, the world of, where he quotes the Rav word by word, the Rav becomes clairvoyant, where you don't realize, is this Rebbe, the Litvisher rational person? And the Rav could reveal in public before thousands of people. The Rebbe, 50 years of Fabrengens, never spoke about himself, never spoke about his life, maybe about the previous Rebbe, maybe about his Melamed. It was clear that the Rebbe was a loner. Now, what's very important here, even before becoming Rebbe, this was a dominant feature of his personality. And here you have the Rav and others who knew the Rebbe in Berlin. Everyone was flabbergasted that he became the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the sense that he conducted his Rebbeship. In Berlin, the Rav says, he was silent, he was quiet. David Holzer quotes the Rav. And you have to know, David Holzer's book, it caused a lot of commotion and a lot of discussion. But I said something, people have repeated it, and I've gotten compliments. They say, you hit the nail on the head. I said, when you approach David Holzer's work, and I love David Holzer, he's a fabulous individual, a very interesting, fascinating individual. Of all the Rav's Talmidim, I would say, if you know David well, he's the most fascinating of all of them. Nine children, each one goes a different way. He raises them, do what you want. This one is Litvish, this one is Torim Derech Eretz. This one comes back to Israel with a Bekesher and a Gartel and lives among the Slonim Hasidim from whom they descend. He goes back to his roots. Very fascinating individual. But David was the Rav's Gabbai, and the Gabbai, and the Rav knew David. I'll give you a simple example. It's Sfira now. All of you know the Rav shaved during Sfira. I shaved till I came in Aliyah, and I see everyone's not shaving, and they're laughing at me and making fun of me, and my grandchildren don't shave, my sons-in-law, don't shave. So, all right, I followed Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I shave on Fridays. Okay, Yom Ha'atzmaut, Lag BaOmer, Baruch Hashem, it'll be over this week. Very hard for me not to shave. I grew up in a certain mode, our era with the Rav. You have to forgive us. You can have all the beards you want, but don't force us into the world that you grew up in. We grew up in a different world. So David presses the Rav. You know, this is the swing to the right already, the late 70s. And I know David very well. He tells me, he says, Rebbe, can I shave during Sfira? And this is already when the Rav stopped shaving. The beard he had, Avelet for his wife. I'm not happy with that beard. That was an Avelet beard. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, when he became Rosh Yeshiva of Kfar HaRoeh, So the Talmidim told him, Rebbe, to be a Rosh Yeshiva, you have to have a beard. So Rav Moshe Tzvineri, I'm paraphrasing the story, but it's the facts are there. Rav Moshe Tzvineri says, all right, I have a beard, I haven't shaved, so it's Sphira now. No, Rebbe, a Sphira beard is not for a Rosh Yeshiva. You have to take off that beard and grow a beard out of joy because you're now a Rosh Yeshiva. So that's what he did. He took off the Sphira beard and he grew a beard out of joy. The Rav's beard was there from Avelin. So everyone knew the Rav shaved. So the Rav, David's present, and the Rav, so the Rav says, for you, David, better you shouldn't shave. Underline the word you. So you understand, the Rav knew who he was talking to. So David's book reads, the Rav thinking aloud. I said, Dad, you're making a mistake with the title. The title has to read, the Rav thinking aloud, not by David Holzer, but to David Holzer. If you view it that way, then you can understand what the Rav is telling David, and people can stop jumping off the roof and off the bridge. And I don't want to go into more detail, but you should know it's the only talk I ever prepared that I never gave. It's in my file cabinet. I can show you the talk. I did a whole review on the book. I was ready to do it in public. Those were days when we still had alumni activities here in Gruss and do a public lecture. And then I saw what hurt the Liechtensteins were very upset. So I saw even if my lecture is positive and critical at the same time, and you know, a balanced lecture, but it would cause a bad feeling. People would be upset. So I never gave the lecture. But it can give you many examples from the book where, again, if you take the title, The Rav Speaking to David Holzer, it turns out David Holzer is quoting the Rav correctly. And this is the Rav speaking to David Holzer. It doesn't mean that's the way the Rav would speak to Vic Snow or to Yomo. Okay? So here, David is totally reliable. He describes, and I quote this in my article in Jewish Action, the Rav describes the Rebbe in Berlin. We would use the Hebrew expression, Nechba El Hakelim. The Rebbe was a recluse, went to university, ran to the mikveh, ran back to learning, ran back to writing Chitushe Torah, which were later published by Chabad, Rishimut it's called. He was a different person. You could never dream that this man could become Rebbe. He was a loner. Some people are lonely, and the others are loners. The Rav makes the same distinction in Hebrew, by the way. Doesn't mean he was lonely. He was surrounded later by thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. But he was a loner. Loners like the Rebbe may be surrounded by others and even maintain lifelong relationships. Still, they do not seem to need many close friends to share confidences or to depend upon. They have a clear purpose, a consuming aim, an intense focus on work to be accomplished. The Rav says this, if you read the start of his essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, just what Eichensteinzel says about the Rebbe, the Rav says this word by word. I'm surrounded by many. I have endless colleagues, disciples, students, friends, but I am lonely. Exactly the same. The Rebbe's closest emotional ties were with his family, his parents, his brother, and later on with his wife. Now, you all know how much the Rebbe speaks about his father, mother, father-in-law, the brother that he had a very unique relationship with, was just that brother's yard sign. Chabad posted many of the things we've spoken about here in class are now posted, and the video where the Rebbe talks about his brother, and he's trying to get a chassid who's a mathematician to edit some of his brother's writings, Chabad is now circulating that all over their websites. And this loneliness, the man being lonely, the uniqueness, his character, this was already in Berlin. in Paris. Who were his friends? How many people can jump up and say they knew him intimately? In Paris, his wife's sister, brother-in-law, the Hornstein family, later killed by Hitler, the third daughter of the Friedrich Rebbe of the Riatz. You take the Rav in Berlin. Who were his friends? Who were his intimates? These were lonely people, people with a task, people with a challenge, people who didn't have a minute to waste. Remember the story I told you the other night, on Monday night, about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. 11 o'clock at night, he's sitting with a rush, with little print, with a 15-watt bulb. Everyone else is asleep in his house. These are people who are living in a different world, a different concept. If they have one friend, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the Rebbe, just like the Rav, how the Rav, you read the Lonely Man of Faith, who is it dedicated to? The Rav's most famous essay, every high school kid in Israel, every college kid, every kid who knows it, the Adam 1 and Adam 2, the Rav, like, it hit the nail on the head. Everyone can relate to it. No, who does he dedicate it to? To his wife, to Tanya. And you know what's fascinating? When you look at the Hebrew edition, the translation, which doesn't equal the Rav's English, nowhere near the Rav's English, when you look at the Hebrew edition, the dedication to his wife was left out when it was originally published in Hebrew. Their mindset here in Mosad Rav Kook, the Rabbanisha mindset, whoever heard of a Gon B'Yisrael dedicating a published work to his wife? Follow? They couldn't comprehend it, couldn't understand it. Left out. Everything else is translated. Just that four-line dedication at the start. Now, the Rebbe and his wife, Rebbitz and Chaya Mashka, were very close. On their anniversary, he would bring her flowers. They would have tea together at home every day, a private ritual that the Rebbe cherished. Listen to this. If one of us were to say this, they'd call us an apikaris. This is the Rebbe speaking. The Rebbe once remarked that the daily tea party, as he called it, was as important to him as putting on tefillin. And you see, here you have to understand, she was raised in royalty. She was raised the daughter of the sixth Rebbe. She was raised on Einikel of the Tzemach Tzedek. She was steeped and ready and capable of accepting a relationship where her husband was preoccupied 20 hours a day, totally devoted to the cause, totally devoted to the ensuing, perpetuating, enhancing the memory and life of her father, the sixth Rebbe. And she understood his calling, his mission. And she understood his soul. She was a perfect support, a perfect marriage where the structure was such that the Rebbe could continue what he was doing. And he valued, he appreciated, he understood. Bringing her flowers, all right, on her anniversary, it's a minor ritual. But a tea party daily, separating from the world, confiding with the one person that he felt a kindred soulmate, calling it as important as putting on tefillin, this was unique. Now, I'm going to say this in parentheses, and Steinholz doesn't say this, but it's something I've often thought about. It could be that this is why the Rebbe had no children. The Rav once gave a Yahrzeit Drasha, the Agada, the 50s, very moving moment in my life. He spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu. And he spoke about the greatest sacrifices that anyone had to make to be the Rabban Shel Yisrael in order to be Moshe Rabbeinu after Matan Torah, Va'ata Po Amodi Madi. And Chazal learned Moshe was commanded he could not leave HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks with him on a daily basis, on a momentary basis. There's no forenotice. You have to be ready at every time to be the Mekabel HaTorah, to be the Rabban Shel Yisrael. And he had to give up what's the most precious aspect of life to any other human being. His wife, his family, his children. The Rav broke down in tears. Separated from his wife, you all know, Miriam, Aaron, we also speak with God. They didn't understand that their relationship was not as unique as Moshe Rabbeinu. But more than that, he had to give up his children. He couldn't devote 1 minute more to his child than he devoted to any other child of Bnei Yisrael, to be the Rabban Shel Yisrael. Ultimately, his grandchildren worship idols. You all know the Medrash Rabbah. Very frightening, the price one has to pay to be the Rabban Shel Yisrael. It could very well be, and I'm thinking aloud as a Litvak, had the Rebbe had children, children have a way of drawing you into the world. They bring you more to a more human relationship with all that's around you. The Rebbe had no children. The Rebbe had nothing that disturbed him from working 24/7 for Klal Yisrael. A supported wife, a wife who understood him, a wife who appreciated what he was doing, and no children. Could be that that was the Gezeirah Mimal, because we needed the Rebbe to do what he did. It's a fascinating thought. You can think about it. Tell you something again in parentheses. And Adam Steinfeld will make this point in a very nice context. But I heard this long ago from a friend of mine who's a Chabadnik, born into Chabad. If you know Yiddish, Agaborna, Nishta Gavorna, Labir. There are many people who become Hasidim today. Many people. Gavarna, they become. A Gavarna is someone born into it. His parents were Chabad, his grandparents were Chabad. And this individual went to YU. But the bulk of the tzedakah he gives and gave, and he's a wealthy man, Kanayin Hara, Chabad. So I once bothered him. We go back to childhood together. I taught his children, I mean, we have a long, long relationship spanning more than 65 years. And I once said to him, why Chabad? You're right, you were born into it, but you've been exposed to YU, exposed to this, exposed to that. You're not a card-carrying Chabadnik in the sense with the uniform and all that goes with it. And he said to me, is there anyone else in the world more dedicated, single-minded to the cause of perpetuating Torah than the Rebbe? Now you just think for a minute. The Rebbe, from the day he becomes Rebbe, you can count, I believe it's three times that he left 770 Eastern Parkway, La Briotte. Three times. Went up to summer camps to see what they were doing, and this was all in the 50s. By the 60s, he never left at all. Hasidim pleaded with the Rebbe, take off a few weeks, go on vacation. You see other Rebbeim, I don't have to give details, the Vishnitzer Rebbe, the Rebbe Gates in London. This one goes to Switzerland. And they say, how can you leave Israel? Mein Tato hat azeh getan, his father did. And this Rebbe goes here, and the Belzer Rebbe has a rest home in Tzfat, and in Kiryat Tel Stone. These are not poor people. To be a Rebbe is not rakefet. This is, wow. Three homes, here, there, everywhere. When did the Lubavitcher Rebbe take off? 1 minute from being Rebbe. I couldn't answer him. And that's why he said, my main support goes to Lubavitch. And I can illustrate, he taught me something else. He gives YU $1,000 a year. So I said to him, I don't mean money, Shach. If you believe in Lubavitch and you worry a little bit about YU's future, why $1,000? Give him $100. He gave me an answer I'll never forget. He said, if you give under $1,000, they bother you with phone calls. You know, the fundraisers know this guy has a little money. But if you give $1,000, from that point on, no one duns you. I think that's the English word with phone calls. They no longer bother you. But what he said about the Rebbe, how can I argue with him? Dr. Ira Weiss. Now, Dr. Ira Weiss is from Chicago originally, if I'm not mistaken. He was called in when the Rebbe had the heart attack in the 70s. I believe it was the late 70s. So, there were very critical decisions that had to be made on the spot. Do you move the Rebbe to a hospital? Don't you move the Rebbe to a hospital? Do you build a hospital around the Rebbe in 770, in his home, actually, which was not in 770, but a few blocks away? Critical decisions. And on Yontif, it was at Simchas Torah, I believe, when he had the heart attack, and they called Chicago, and Dr. Weiss flew into New York to take care of the Rebbe and became very, very close to the family. By the way, when he arrived at the Rebbe's home, rushing, the first thing the Rebbetzin said, you have to make Kiddush, it's Yontif, and insisted he make Kiddush before he go in to examine the Rebbe. His cardiologist, Dr. Ira Weiss, was privy to the couple's personal feelings for one another and described their deep love and respect. The Rebbetzin was his intellectual sparring partner. That sentence could have been written about Tanya and the Rav, word by word. That was the Rav's intellectual sparring partner. Unbelievable. She protected him as much as she could. At the same time, the Rebbe asked Dr. Weiss to reassure the Rebbetzin as he recovered from his heart attack in 1977, and Dr. Weiss is now quoting the Rebbe, she is always so worried, the Rebbe said. Now, what type of life did the Rebbetzin have? Talk about a marriage. This takes us into a problem that all of you young rabbis, if you go into the rabbinate, go into chinuch to a lesser degree, but certainly will have the problem, what we spoke about yesterday, you recall outreach, the outreach syndrome. I don't know how we got into it with Erev, but whatever, we got a whole discussion with outreach, the new field for young rabbis. What role does the Rebbetzin play? And this is a real problem, because you're a rabbi, she's a Rebbetzin. And if you're a medical doctor, what does that make her? Her nurse, a medical assistant, or whatever title you want to give her? And you know what happened here in this very building, the last time that Reb Aaron Lichtenstein and a dummy named Rakefet appeared together, that last Shabbat when we were all together, my wife, myself, Reb Aaron and Tova, was an unbelievable Shabbos. You can ask Rabbi Miller. Rabbi Miller and I both said the same thing after Shabbos. Too bad we couldn't record what went on here. Oh boy, if I could have recorded that Shabbat, I would be a very wealthy man today. What we could have sold. Anyway, when Tova was introduced, they introduced her as Rebbetzin. And she got up and ripped the heck out of them. Schwat Rebbetzin. Dr. Tom, she stands in her own right, her own 2 feet, her own accomplishments. Her husband may be a rab. What does that have to do with her? Very powerful talk on feminism and self-identity and a woman and Tovah, you should know, Tovah and Atara, terrific women, from 1,000% dedication, daven 3 times a day. They're not feminist, but the woman, stands on her own 2 feet. Interesting. In parentheses, this may be the solution with all the women today who have yo'atzot halacha and know how to learn. It could be in every synagogue today, we need a female personality appointed as the advisor for yo'atzot halacha, chayei mishpacha, to play the role that the Rebbetzin used to play when she was trained or not trained for it. Today we can train women 1,000%. Could be. Now, what's fascinating about the Rebbetzin, she was even a more private person than the Rebbe. And here, you have to ask the question, why? After all, she was raised in a royal home. She knows that when a child is born, we spoke about this yesterday, Rabbi Rubin took off for England yesterday to celebrate the birth of the fourth removed from inheriting the queen, a new child is born. Oh, no? And I said yesterday, who here is of Belza Hasidic extraction? Rafi Klein, Hungarian blood in you, Abelza Adanish.
Yeah.
Rafi Klein has to give Kiddush. The Belzer Rebbe had another grandson last week. You know what that means? The Belzer Rebbe was the only survivor. I can't go into all the details now. His uncle's entire family was wiped out, 11 children. He couldn't have children for years. What the man went through all over the world, America here, they tried, they helped. Finally he had an Ains Einikazun, a miracle. And that son has many children. The bells are dancing on the trees today. Dancing on the tables. You ever see Chassidim dance on the table? Go to the internet, type in Purim, Chassidim dancing. You will see it. Rafi, she was raised in a Rebbe's home. The world rejoices. The Rebbe has another daughter. There'll be a great son-in-law one day. She saw her father a public figure. Why was she so reticent? Why was she such a private individual? All right, there can be many psychological interpretations. Could be she was very unique, like the Rebbe. Could be the fact that she was raised in the public limelight. She pushed back. But there may be an entirely different interpretation, which probably, even if it isn't entirely correct, is a good part of the scene. In a Hasidic house, family loyalty is extremely important. Malchut, royalty, you're part of the family. Rebbetzin Chaya Mushka was caught up in a family quagmire that is the biggest source of aggravation, atmos nefesh, tension in the family's history in the years in America. And here you have a human situation which really has no solution. Chaya Mushka's oldest sister, her oldest sister, was married to Rav Shmaru Guraye. Rav Shmaru Guraye, also a cousin of the Rebbe, also related to Chabad, also related to the Schneersons. He assisted the Rebbe from the day he entered the family. He never parted from the Rebbe. They lived together. I'm talking about the sixth Rebbe. He never parted from the Riyats. They lived together. He was a fine Talmud Chacham. He was not Reb Menachem Mendel. Reb Menachem Mendel was unique. You don't find many like Reb Menachem Mendel. Reb Al Lichtenstein, unique. The Rav, unique. But Reb Shmai Guraya was a fine Talmud Chacham. Torah Tanigla, Torah Tanista. But more than that, he assisted the Rebbe at every turn. He was part and parcel of the sixth Rebbe's household. He was never more than a few minutes away from the Rebbe, both physically and spiritually. They lived under one roof for decades. he thought he would become the seventh Rebbe. His wife, the older sister of Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka, felt her husband would become the seventh Rebbe. The widow of the Riatz wanted this son-in-law to be the seventh Rebbe. But the Hasidim interfered. And this takes us back to the whole question of democracy and royalty and yichus and inheritance. Willy-nilly, Hasidim play a big role. And particularly in this context, where Lubavitch was cut off, where Lubavitch was pushed sideways, where Lubavitch runs away trying to save their lives from Europe, comes to a strange land, a different country, a golden Medina, the United States, a country where democracy rules. And you all know, when the sixth Rebbe died, Rav Shmarga was ready to take over. Chassidim were hesitant. And one full year went by, and the Chassidim chose the younger son-in-law. At times, it is quite clear, he didn't want it. He ran away. He hid. But somehow the forces of life, the pressure, the voice of the Hasidim demanded, Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, God created you for one purpose, to succeed your father-in-law. And this caused tension that survives until today. We'll go into great detail of the controversy with the books, the court case, the testimony, but that's not yet. What's important to understand that it could very well be that one of the reasons Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka exited from the stage was not to offend her mother and her sister. Could very well be. And this is why they say she didn't attend the Fabrengens with everyone else. She always was worried if she attends, she'll get covered malachim, the Rebbe's wife. It'll be offensive to her sister and mother. I told you that I met the Pnei Menachem's Rebbetzin. The minute she walked into the room, everyone jumped up for her. Everyone present, man, woman, and child. Chaya Mushka listened to every sicha her husband gave. Many times, this is exactly like the Rav, many times he bounced ideas off her when he had tea with her. Exactly like the Rav. The Rav speaks about in Al HaTshuva, how when he would prepare his tshuva drashot, he would bounce the ideas off Rebbetzin and Tanya. It's an amazing the parallels here. And see her reaction, and she would fine-tune it. She listened via telephone. She listened via what came afterwards when they improved upon the telephone connections. She always waited up for the Rebbe to come home. He could come home 6 a.m. in the morning, up all night, spoke from 10 to 5, 10 to 4:30. I have no idea how long these Fabrengens went on. But she didn't appear in public. Could very well be, in addition to her own personality, her own reticence, her own modesty, call it what you wish, but there's no question she didn't want to offend her mother and her sister. So this too is part of it. She was a very private person. The Rebbetzin fought for her privacy. When she went out on her own, she drove to stores outside the neighborhood. Here too it's interesting. Who drove the car? The Rebbetzin. When the Rav drove in from Boston in the late 40s, beginning with 49, I think they had the car into the 50s. It was quiet. Till then he came in by train. Then he came in by car. The black Dodge. Who drove the car? Rebbetzin Tanya. The parallels are fascinating. Once she was in Williamsburg shopping outside of the neighborhood, and the Satmar Rebbetzin walked into the store and saw who it was and greeted her by name. Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka told the person who had come with her to help her carry the packages that she would not shop at that store again because she had been recognized. And you see, here too, Rabbi Steinfeld has a paragraph. I want to comment on it. Let me read to you what he says. It does seem clear to me, though, that the Rebbe's wife lived a full life, albeit one on her own terms. She was the Rebbe's only true confidant. Now, you see, what's happened here, and something that a married person struggles with, and it's part of working out a happy marriage. You have to allow your partner freedom. Each person has to work out their own gestalt, their own lifestyle, their own understanding. You see that the Lubavitcher Rebbe here with his own wife was exactly the way he understood how to interact with the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands who sought his guidance. One mold does not fit everybody. And when I first got married, I thought, you marry, it gives you two votes. Your wife has to vote exactly the way you vote. That's what I thought when I first got married. I can tell you all the years we've lived in Israel, it's only in the last two elections that we voted the same party. Only the last two elections. We both voted Bennett. But all the other years, I voted Maftal and she voted Kahana. Inevitably. If it was not Kahana, then when Kahana was gone, so Arik Sharon, I'm not exactly one to bless his memory. He at one time was a big right-winger. Remember, whenever there was a right-wing party, that had my wife's vote. And I have to tell you, I learned not only to live with it, but I learned to encourage it. And this is the Rebbe. See, his wife, independent, not the classic Rebbetzin. Doesn't attend the sichat, listening via the telephone, via the hookup. But this was her life. This was the Rebbetzin. This was his confidant. This was the only person that the Rebbe could trust, that the Rebbe could talk to, that would understand the Rebbe fully. And she also... very hard. If you wanted to reach the Rebbe, you couldn't reach the Rebbe through her, basically. An appointment through the Rebbe had to be through her Gabayim. She was in a different world. On the other hand, when calls came in for the Rebbe, when the Rebbe was asleep and the Gabayim, the Rebbe label Groner and others had to wake the Rebbe up, she would receive the calls with understanding and wake him up because she knew the Hasidus depended upon her. It's a very, very insightful description. The Rebbetzin adored the Rebbe. After the Rebbetzin commented that her father had only one chassid, and that was her husband, the seventh Rebbe, the chassidim would add, and the Rebbe has only one chassid, and that is his wife. And that's a powerful comment. Could say the same thing about Moriu Rebbe. When all was said and done, his greatest Talmud, his greatest devotee, was Rebbetzin Tanya. After her death, the Rebbe said of her in public, only God can estimate her greatness. The passing of his wife meant the loss of his only friend significantly at a late stage in his life. And this paragraph here, this sentence by Rav Steinsaltz, I'm I'm just overwhelmed by its insight and beauty and correctness. At that letter age, married couples have often grown to become only almost one entity. And when one of the partners is taken away, the other is left with a feeling of incompleteness. I believe this is how the Rebbe felt. I have to tell you, quote, end quote, sign on the dotted line. I have lots of problems with marriage today. Divorce, I don't know. To me, if you live by Torah and live as a human being, v'hayula b'sar echad, there's nothing more eternal, nothing more substantial, no greater achievement than a husband and wife celebrating 50, 60. Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, over 70 years with his wife. Now I know that people in this room and people listening, God has willed otherwise. I'm not saying you don't remarry, chas v'chalila. People have to remarry, people have to forge a new relationship. God wills otherwise, but this is the ideal. Halavai. And this is exactly the Rav. I quote the Rav now. I heard this with my own ears. 1977, when the State of Israel sent me back to address the RCA convention. And I'm quoting the Rav. When my wife died, part of me went down to the grave with her. In parentheses, just to lighten up the mood, I can tell you afterwards, we walked out, you know, the rabbis, all these important rabbis. I cannot tell you what went on outside in the hallway. Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, the wise Alec, the sarcastic Rabbi Yeruchim, Event Nachshish Saint Senya, he's still crying. What's with him? It's 10 years. It was 77, 67. And then another rabbi, I don't want to mention his name, a chubby guy, and he's dancing around, a successful rabbi and a whole crowd around him. And he says, if he would take my Macha Shefer from me, I would dance and daven with extra kavana. And this is in front of the younger rabbi. Oh, what went on in the hallway? But I have to tell you, I was more influenced by the Rav than by the foolishness of what was being said. Now, he also, it's a very powerful, powerful passage. And I don't think Rabbi Atten Steinsaltz recognizes or realizes how similar these thoughts are to the Rav. Now, the Rebbe was childless, and there's no question when someone is childless, it affects his gestalt, his personality. The Rebbe loved children. Whenever you see pictures of him, he's surrounded by little children. The Rebbe walking up the steps, coming down the steps from 770, little children waiting. He would treat children affectionately and would hand out coins to those who gathered around him. In his later years, small children would sit close to him and on the stairs leading up to the stage during his public appearances. One letter that he wrote to an individual who complained to the Rebbe that his life was nothing but a string of disappointments and failures, and he had not even a single source of joy. The Rebbe responded, "From your letter I understand, among other things, that you have a wife and children. Don't you know that there are people who would give up everything in order to have a family?" And here too, I cite to you from my, what can I say, I'm humbled, I don't want to call her a colleague, but she was my colleague in teaching, Nechama Leibovich. And we, you know, if you've studied Washington, you know we had a deep relationship, not a simple relationship. I even had the chutzpah to argue with her, the ongoing argument that I would speak English, not Hebrew, when they stopped, you know, I knew Hebrew, but when they don't understand Hebrew, it's like speaking Yiddish. And I would tell her, Nechama, yesh li sha'a, shana achat, tfos otam. Achachachem Yaluatza, you will do what they're called. They don't have to live in Beit Shemesh. And so instead, Beit Shemesh, 3 minutes from Israel. That's Yehuda Sparrow said, I think, to my wife, I live 3 minutes from Israel. Nechama Leibowitz said exactly the same thing. I would give up all my knowledge if I could have only had a child. So, you see, you're childless, but Minishamayim, if you view it in the context of what I just said, then it's a Gezerah Minishamayim. In order to be the Rabban Shel Yisrael, and I still remember the Rav breaking down and crying, the Rabban Shel Yisrael, et aviv lo yadat imolo hikir, ata po amodi madi. Couldn't leave. That was the Rebbe. Now, here Rav Avin Steinsaltz is fabulous. I'm quoting now from page 168. And he says, you know, we're all people with many facets, many sides to our life. Morty, you were at MIT, right? Or not at MIT, you were at Weizmann Institute. Morcha should have been MIT. Okay, I wonder if Rabbi Meiselman would tell me not to tell anyone he has a doctorate from Weizmann. MIT, don't tell anyone. Weizmann, Morcha should. Okay. Tell me, the way you conducted yourself in Weizmann is the way you conducted yourself at home? The way you conducted yourself at home with your wife, your children, is that the way you conducted yourself in shul? Charlie, we're different people. We have many personalities. I come home. You should know that if the weather permits, I'll take off all my clothes and just put on pajamas because I'm going to go to sleep after I eat brunch, lunch, whatever you want to call it. Total. Take off my shoes, slippers, relaxed. Okay? Guy is giving a shiur in public, hitting away, kala Torah kula, and then a few hours later on the Yankee website to see what the Yankees have done. I'm going to have to start wearing my Yankee cap. I so far so good this year. I can be proud. Right or wrong, Vic? I got to pull out the yarn. Now I can't see the baseball cap is the YU cap in Israel. But you see, we're different people. Adin Steinsaltz makes sense. And by the way, the Rav, I'll tell you with the Rav, I mean, I'll tell you here a little family story that I'm privileged to know from the family. You know what the Rav's escape was? You won't believe it. He was a man that such pressure was on him and people are running after him and shilas and difficulties. A Western movie he loved. Cowboys and Indians. Western movies. And the family told me after his wife died, and it's a well-known story, he was living with the Tweskys. So one time a man came knocking on the door, and they told him, is it pressing or can it wait till tomorrow morning? So the man said, no, I'll see him at Minyan tomorrow, it's okay. And he went away. He said he thought the Rav was involved in who knows what. The Rav was totally lost in a Western, and they didn't want to disturb him. The family felt, thank God, his mind is off his tzaris, off his Agmas Nefesh, off the loss of his wife. Don't disturb him while he's watching that Western. So, you know, we're all like that. We're all like that. Take my word for it. All of us are like that. That's the whole literature today about recreational time. Is recreation allowed? I'm serious. Halachic literature. I've already seen articles. Do yeshiva to close for 3 weeks? Who ever heard of such a thing? All right, Chodesh Nisan, I can understand you're getting ready for Pesach Mela. All right. I can understand. But 3 weeks in the summer, you take off. But recreation, you come back, you're stronger. A lot has been written. No, recreation. What about going to a Broadway show? An escape? In my time, no one raised the issue of Kalisha, but okay, we'll leave that problem for. What about going to an opera? Right or wrong? That's David Miller's famous story, which he, Baruch Hashem, continues. You get the story from him, not from me. But the story, you know, he asked the Rav, Rebbe, can you go to an opera? The Rav says, what's the Shaila? So he says to the Rav, Kol Isha. The Rav says, and you know what Kol Isha is? And the Rav walks away. You can draw your own conclusions. But Rabbi Deutsch came up, he found that Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner had a membership card to the opera in Berlin. And I know as a fact that the Rav went to operas in Berlin. I can prove it to you. It's not for now, but I can prove it to you, actually. So, you know, we all, recreation, where do you draw the line? Rakefet, I told you, I did a terror, and I didn't tell you, I told someone else, I did a terrible thing. I never thought the day would come. They wanted to take me to a Yankee game in Connecticut, and I had to turn it down because I fly the next day to Toronto. I'm old, I need my strength. I can't exactly go from Connecticut to Yankee Stadium, come back, all right? I'm being driven, I'm treated royalty, I'm sitting in a box seat. Hashtia kadat ain't on ace. They'll bring me kosher glatosha hot dogs, but I'm older. But imagine that, as I said, maybe we'll watch the game a little bit on TV. Baruch Hashem, recreation. This morning I saw two Yankees hit home runs yesterday. Baruch Hashem, Yankee website. Compliments of Chris. No, serious question. Tell me, the Rebbe, from the moment he became Rebbe, was never a private person again. The Rebbe never stopped being a Rebbe. Most of us make a distinction between our public professional roles and our personal life. When we shut the door, we become more of ourselves. Even heads of state and spiritual leaders often, quote, put on their slippers, end quote, as the Hebrew saying goes. But the Rebbe was not like that. So far as everyone knows, there was neither a time nor a situation when he reverted to the very private person he had been before becoming the leader of the movement. For him, becoming a Rebbe seemed to be a kind of a death sentence. That's his word. I would use the word a kind of a life sentence. In some sense, he ceased to be an ordinary human being. His personal life was set aside. The purpose, the idea, the mission of spiritual leadership was the only thing that mattered to him. From the moment, this is very sharp now, from the moment he was appointed leader of Chabad, the Rebbe seemed profoundly transformed. Menachem Mendel Schneerson disappeared. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe took his place. In effect, he existed solely as part of a collective, albeit the most important part, as thinker and leader. But he was part of a collected unit. He was no longer an individual. He was Lubavitcher Rebbe, very powerful. Soon after he was crowned as Rebbe, the 18th century Polish Hasidic leader Moshe Leib of Sasov was offered a bowl of soup. A minute or two later, he put down the spoon and said, quote, I still enjoyed it. It seems I am not a Rebbe yet. A Rebbe's connection is with the Hasidim, with their spiritual and other needs, not with his own mundane world. It's very powerful, but very true. That will explain to you why the Rebbe worked 7/24, why he never, ever took a vacation. Here he says what I just told you. Those close to the Rebbe would occasionally beg of him to take a short rest. They would remind him that the course of generations, Chabad Rebbes, like many other Rebbes, had taken an occasional vacation. They even would remind him that even his father-in-law, the Riatz, went away for rest and recuperation at times. Yet the Rebbe never agreed to this idea. His role as Rebbe was all-consuming. The Rebbe no longer had the structure of a private life to fall back on. He and the movement were entirely one. And now you can understand. Perhaps his loneliness was inevitable. Those who had once been his peers, workmates, and colleagues became his subordinates and Hasidim. Although their relationships continued, they were no longer ordinary friendships. having assumed the responsibility of solving his chassidim's personal problems, he could no longer talk to them as an equal. This created an existential choice for loneliness, which might even be termed aloneness with an A. From his deep relationship with his family, we know he had the capacity of intimacy with others, yet in the official role that consumed his life, it could not be expressed. And here let me add one word to the credit. Family fights are difficult. I remember, again, one of the people that I was very close with when I was at YU, although he was, I would say, 9 years older, Rabbi Teddy or Yehuda Panis. You've heard the name? Rabbi Panis was a Rebbe, then he went to Landa. Should live and be well. A wonderful, wonderful individual. And I remember Teddy said to me, we were talking about when the families get together, he said there's always tension when families get together. He says at Chagim, when we have cousins and relatives and aunts and uncles, and it's inevitable. I often say to my wife, "Ain bayit she'ein shamei." There's no family that you can say everyone gets along fine. And unfortunately, the greater the family is, at times, the more deep the difficulty, controversy is as well. So the Rebbe had a problem. His mother-in-law, we'll come to it yet. We're going to talk about it. If not this year, we have just two lectures left after today. Next year, Be'ezrat Hashem, God should give strength. I will talk about it. There's a lot to be said. You can turn it into a movie. The Rebbe's mother-in-law, his sister-in-law, Reb Shmaya Guraye, became a chassid of the Rebbe. 100%. And this requires greatness. His older brother-in-law, who was so close to the Riyatz, and the family wanted him to inherit the throne, he later becomes a total dedicated chassid, min hashura, who sat before the Rebbe, b'yira, ubepachat. And he actually splits with his wife in their attitude that all that happens within the family. And you see, this is what he says. These are people who, his brother-in-law, friendly, older. At one point, the 6th, 7th Rebbe was positive his brother-in-law would become the Rebbe. And now, he's the Rebbe. These are his chassidim. You can no longer talk to a Rebbe like you talk to someone who's your colleague, like you talk to someone when you're a Talmud Chaver. This is not the Litvish world. Could you imagine a chutzpan like Rothkopf speaks to Rabbi Aaron Cutler? And I told you before, and I'm telling Rabbi Aaron Cutler all that I got out of Bnei Akiva. Nope. You think you can talk that way to a Rebbe when you're a chassid? And it could be he had no choice. Loneliness went with the position, went with the dedication, went with the vision, the price one had to pay. Va'ata po amod imadi. I see my Rebbe before my eyes. By the way, I can tell you in parentheses, all the Meivinim, you know, when the Rebbe gave a shiur, the 1950s, he was not unknown. The crowd was there from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. People knew him. People knew the family. People had learned with Reb Meisha. I was surrounded by the Elter Talmidim, yet knew Reb Meisha. The Elter Rabbanim, yet knew Reb Meisha Soloveitchik I'm talking about. So many people said that the Rebbe broke down and cried because he was talking about his own father. That when he said Moshe, Batapod Modi Madi, he was relating to his own father and his father's break with his family and the aggravation and the father and his mother become Mizrachiites and the father's teaching at YU and you know Reb Velvel and you know yesterday or a week ago in our Sunday class we have a survivor in the class, and he knows the Soloveitchik family, and he mentioned to Reb David Meshulam something that he studies with Talmidim of Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi, Mori Rebbe, and Reb David Meshulam turned away like, how do you mention his name in my presence? And he was all upset. How can anyone speak this way? And it could be that when the Rav spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu and the task and the vision and the dedication, Vata po amodi mati. And I hope Chaim Maltz, Herbie Maltz, hears what I just said, because he's still troubled. He asked me again yesterday. Was it in class he asked me, or before class? I don't remember. And he asked me again, how could Reb David Meshulam talk this way about the Rav? So it could be that the Elder Rabbanim were right when he spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, his father, the Rav was like Yosef, so he gave so many drashot, and Yosef at Tzadik, and his dreams, and his machlokes with his brothers, and in that entire interpretation, many people said the Rav was talking about himself. Could be. And here, Aton Steinsel adds something amazing. He proves his point. After his massive heart attack in 1977, the Rebbe wanted to speak to his Hasidim from his bed. When his cardiologist, Dr. Weiss, objected, he replied, quote, up to now you have been my doctor, and I have had to obey you. Now I am the Rebbe, and I have to do what I have to do. So you see, that's a very powerful quote. Notice, he didn't say, now I am the Rebbe and you have to obey me. He said, now I am the Rebbe and I have to do what you have to do. And here Aiton Steinsel says a personal note that's right about us here. Baruch HaTovah. The problem in Israel, the left wing, Meretz, Meimad at the time, Rav Amital, Rav Lichtenstein, you all know what we've lived through. Those of you who were here lived through it. The rest of you know about it. People can't go on fighting a war forever. You become dispirited. And you have people in Israel who are intelligent people, but you can take out an axe to chop their heads off, and they'll look at the axe and think it's a knife to cut up chopped liver for you. And you know, we can't go on, we have to make peace, we have to give away Yerushalayim, we have to compromise, we have to do this and that, and dispirited. And it's a problem, it's reflected in the electorate. In this past election, that was not an issue. There were other issues, but that was not the issue. But I've lived through elections where that was the issue. And Rabbi Aton Steinsel says, by the Rebbe, he doesn't say what year, maybe it's the 80s, maybe it's at the time right after the Yom Kippur War, the 70s, or after the first Lebanese War. When I once told the Rebbe that the people of Israel were becoming more and more tired of politics, bloodshed, and war, and that there was a corresponding shift in public opinion, the Rebbe replied, he could not understand how a people could become tired. It seemed strange to him, even bizarre, that the people could truly become dispirited. See, the Rebbe never lost the zest, never lost the commitment, the vision, the kirov, the outreach. The Rebbe was an island of loneliness in a crowd of people. He was equally alone when he was by himself in a room, as he met scores of delegations from outside the movement, and when he was surrounded by thousands of Hasidim. He was alone. He was unique. He was the Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe described those who are fish of the sea who walk on dry land. That's the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He's a fish. He belongs in the sea. But he's walking on dry land, like many others who belong heart and soul to a reality different from their own. The Rebbe dressed like those around him and appeared to be like them without actually belonging to their world. He dedicated his life to the Jewish people, but he still was a stranger in a strange land. I don't think there is a better chapter on the personality of the Rebbe, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with himself, the human being, than that chapter from Adin Steinsaltz. But I want to go one step further and end off the class. I have a lot of freebies and I have a big surprise to show you. Tell me, Moshe, you have a good mind. I'm quoting to you Adin Steinsaltz. He's a chassid. What do you expect the chassid to say? He just gave us a terrific description, and I admit, Rebbe, meaning Aaron Rakefet, but you added from your Rebbe's drasha, Moshe Rabbeinu Atapo, Amod Madi, very moving, very beautiful, but you're a bunch of chassidim. Maybe you're prejudiced. So I have to tell you, a sefer came out, it's a few years ago. Sodo Shel HaRebbe by Yechiel Harari. And this sefer was one of the first to come out about the Rebbe. It's written by someone who obviously has, there are many stories written about the Rebbe. Some of them are written with a prejudice, some written with an axe to grind, some are written have a goal, some want to put down the Rebbe. This sefer was written by someone who was very positive, but was not an intimate chassid. From the name, if I'm not mistaken, Yechiel Harari even indicates it's not even Ashkenazi, it can be a Sephardi, but there are many Eidot HaMizrach people who are Lubavitcher. And you know what's amazing? In this sefer, which predates Adin Steinsaltz by a few years, you have Bekitzur, not as beautifully written, not with the deep insight of Adin, but you have Bekitzur, exactly the same description of the Rav and the Rebbitzin. And Ha'isha Shelitzido, that's a modern Hebraic expression. I'm quoting beginning on page 173. He describes their relationship. She was totally devoted to the Rebbe. Outside of a brief period in Paris where she worked in a store, I believe it was, she never worked again in her life. She was the Rebbe's right hand. What did she do all day? She read a great deal. Her native language, obviously, was Yiddish, Russian. She mastered French. She was never totally at home in English. She knew English, basic English to get along, but she was much more at home in Yiddish and French. But part of the story, very fascinating, President of the United States walks into his office, 9 o'clock on Monday morning. What awaits him? A dossier prepared by specialists, what the president has to know. Aaron Rakefet walks into Gruss. When Sherry comes in, she starts printing out material from the email. You should see the emails that come in. Wonderful Talmidim who want me to be informed what Rakefet should know. I get emails on Hasidus, I get emails on the Rav, I get emails on Litvisha, I get emails on Israeli politics, I get emails on baseball. What the Rebbe should know. Do you know that the Rebbitzin used to prepare for the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Every morning she went through newspapers in various languages, English, German, French, Yiddish, prepared for the Rebbe, cut out, they told me, would mark up what the Rebbe should know, what he should be aware of. Her closest friends were some of the wives of the Elter Hasidim. She was very close to the wife of the Chozer, Rabbi Yochel Cohen, who may be the greatest Lubavitch Lamdin alive today, should live and be well into his 80s, late 80s, maybe 90s. I'm talking about the Chozer. This is Rabbi Yochel Cohen, who used to stand up after the Rebbe gave a shmuis and would repeat it word by word by word, even with the same grimaces and smiles that the Rebbe had when he said these words. Many of the shmuisim that the Rebbe gave on Shabbos, we have written up, because after Shabbos, the Chozer of Yoro would repeat it word by word, and a stenographer would write it down. His wife was evidently the Rebbetzin's closest friend. She was also very close with her older sister, Chana, who all that tension later develops when her husband succeeds as Rebbe and not the husband of Chana, and their relationship, exactly the description, if not with all the philosophical analysis, that Rabbi Eigenstein Zolz gives. So that we can say, here's a Ne'eman, who's not necessarily a total devotee, Hasid, painting it with multicolored glasses. He is a scholar, and he reaches exactly the same conclusions, even giving us a little bit more details on the literature, the Russian literature she loved, Chekhov, Pushkin, and who she could discuss it with, and the Rebbetzin of Yoel Cohen. He's visited Israel a number of times. Whenever he visits, he's the main speaker at any Chabad event. So my dear students, to summarize, we're in the middle, and we're not going to finish this term, we have a lot more to do, but we're trying to understand who the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe was, the history of Torah in the United States. The Lubavitcher Rebbe plays a major role of the miracles that have happened. Remember, I grew up in an era where everyone was running away from Yiddishkeit, and today we live in an era where so many wonderful people are running to Yiddishkeit. We're living in a generation of Balei Tshuva, it's called. I don't like the word Balei Tshuva. Bal Tshuva can be someone like me, who all my life I've lived among Gedolei Yisrael, but someone who knew nothing and discovers his roots, how can you call him a Bal Tshuva? You have to call him a Gale Amukot. He uncovers the depth of what it means to be a Jew, the romance of a Jew and Torah. One question for you, Yomo. Where is Alex?
He's in his room.
I haven't seen him in 2 weeks. Is he okay?
He hasn't been seen well. He has to take a bechina.
I hate that word, bechina. I would abolish all bechina. Learning is lishma and happiness. And if you have a good Rebbe and you're dancing on the table, that's the bechina. If you can't dance on the table, you flunked. My grandchildren got upset. They said, what do you mean dancing on the table? I showed them a video. Hasidim, their grandfather's not lying. Because that's my expression. I told you, on Yom HaCharon, on Shabbos, which was really not Pesach anymore, so I gave these wise Alex egg matzah. All Pesach, they're butchering how bad matzah is. So first I gave them whole wheat matzah. Oh, they admitted it's not bad. The egg matzah. Now I got grandchildren who want to know why we can't be svardim and have egg matzah all of Pesach. All right, I told them, let your daughters marry Eidot HaMizrach boys, and Baruch Hashem, they'll eat egg matzah. You'll ask me a shayla in 100 years. If you're visiting your children, you served egg matzah. Cholamayit, we'll talk about it then, okay? Give it time. So what do we do today? Today, the Rebbe and his relationship with Chassidim, with his wife, with his relationship of being a Rebbe, and a lot of interesting contrast to the Rav. Very fascinating. And I am humbled. It brings back beautiful memories. I can never forget that Rasha. Va'ata po amod imadi. And the Shia dedicated to the memory of Ar Asaraf. Zichrono Livracha. It hurts. A kid wounded in battle, goes on a tour, see the world, and another friend, and he was in my grandson's unit. Another someone, my grandson's commander, who danced so beautifully at his wedding, was so badly injured. So the army took all these people who were badly injured. They're touring now India. So, you know, it gives them a chance to see the world. And thank God our tax money goes for a good purpose. I don't mind paying taxes. I just want to see it go for a good purpose. Baruch Hashem. Gentlemen, gather around me. Something to show you. Charlie, do you read English? Here. Come. Don't be afraid. You have to see it. Gather around me, I said. Read what this is. Read it. The English. Read it aloud.
We take pleasure in inviting you to celebrate with us the marriage of our children, Tova and Aaron. The wedding will take place on Tuesday evening, December 22nd, 1959, at 6 o'clock in the Dorothy Quincy Suite of the John Hancock Building, 33355 Stewart Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Joseph and Tanya Salvechik, Yechiel and Bluma Lichtenstein.
Can you now? Yeah. Now, here, read this. And no one knew it, but I had to explain it. I couldn't believe it.
Due to illness in our family, the marriage of our daughter, Tova, to Aaron Lichtenstein, has been postponed from Tuesday, December 22nd, 1959, to Tuesday, January 26th, 1960. The wedding will take place, please God, at 6 p.m. in the Dorothy Quincy Suite of the John Hancock Hall, 355 Stewart Street, Boston. We hope that you'll be able to be with us at that time. Joseph and Tanya Salavechik. Reception in honor of the groom at 5 p.m.
Now, do you know what it means due to illness? That was the Rav's cancer operation. That the Rav survived at that point in time was a great, great miracle. Now, this is the Hesped that I recommended to you. I made some copies of it. You wanted, and this is the original. If anyone wants the Mochach, it's a very beautiful Hesped. If anyone wants the description of the Rebbe's marriage, I have another copy of what I read from last week. It's yours. Now, this is unbelievable what happens to us. I thank Chaim Schnitzer for sending it. What can I tell you? If you recall, we once mentioned the Shtetner Rebbe, who was on the Shtetner Rebbe. Here it says Shtetner Rebbe, who was on the east side, and there was a brother in Toronto. And here's the notice of the Rebbe's death. This is his son, a conservative rabbi. Okay? I couldn't believe us vet from our mention of America. And this is his granddaughter, a rabbi, Fahaya, the granddaughter of the Shtetner Rebbe. Here she is, and she tells you, thanks to visiting my website, I'm honored to be a rabbi in the vibrant, open-hearted Jewish community in the Washington, D.C. area. And I'm blessed to be able to teach and learn, lead services, facilitate life passages, write and edit, and serve as a pastoral counselor. I invite you to browse on this website and join me at services or in meditation or healing group. If you have a chance to read a sermon or article, I'll welcome your feedback. If there's something I can help you with, from leading a healing service to officiating at a wedding or bar bat mitzvah or starting an adult education program, please drop me a line. Kol haneshama tahalel ka. May every soul be lifted up in joyous praise. Anyone? You are Shtetner Chassid?
That was at the Synagogue of Washington, right?
That's where
I grew up.
That's where you grew up, okay.
It changed.
Anyone who reads modern Hebrew, one of my books I'm clearing out of my library, if you want to have a good time reading about Aryeh Deri in his youth, who he was, what he dreamt about, and the man who today owns the country, plain and simple. And if he had his way, he would force Bayit Yehudi not to join the coalition. He would force Liebman not to join the coalition, and thereby force a national unity government left of center. Aryeh Deri, enjoy. This was sent to me by someone who's related to Morty Tarrigan, his cousin. If you, I quote the story in Washington. If you don't know it, it's worthwhile. It's about Rabbi Gustman, 1982, about the boy who fell in battle, Rabbi Gustman's Divrei Nicham. Anyone interested in the history of Jews in America, once again, Moreshet Chachmei America. See, they show you the, what Jews look like in America. Rabbanim Barak Kefen has one comment to make. Did they have any influence whatsoever? I would rather take all the Rabbanim I knew who were clean-shaven and dressed like Yankees, and boy, did we have influence. But interesting material. Part of the debate, the New York Times picks up on everything going on in Israel. The problem with buses running on Shabbos, this past Shabbos, buses, a bus began running in Jerusalem. Outside Ashdod, a shopping center opened, and I have a lot to say about it. I feel very, very strongly that if we do this, we become murderers. And you may quote me, because we had no right to lift up a gun to an Arab if we're not a Jewish state. And that, by definition, is a Jewish state. I don't go into people's homes, but the public thoroughfare has to be Jewish. I hope we can boycott anything that has to do with that Ashdod shopping center. And it hurts me that Haredim lead the battle. Our voice of the Kippot Srugot should be heard as well. Those of you who are in the Russian situation, a great refusenik just died, Vladimir Slepak. One of the usual stories of someone like Eden Udel, never totally adjusted to here. And this is part of life. An Olech Hadash who adjusts to here, I mean, from someone who came in my period, you understand? Today, there's so many Americans here, it's you can adjust very easily. This is from Lubavitcher Rebbe's letters, the Rebbe's letters to Ben-Gurion, Shazah, Shmuel Yosef Zevin, Geula Kohn, very fascinating. Where's Yomo? Give that to our friend Alex Glassman, tell him I think of him. Another description, I don't know where this is from, I looked it up, from the Rebbe's wedding, from a published book, not just an article. Who here is interested in literature? This is from the latest tradition dedicated to Rabbi Lichtenstein, the best that has been thought and said by Rabbi Lichtenstein about the role of literature in religious education. And this is all about literature. And finally, this is a printout of a, I've now got it as a booklet. You know the name Benjamin Brown, the genius who published that PhD on the Chazon Ish, a tremendous work. Anyway, he did research for the Israel Democracy Institute on leadership in the Haredi world, the Litvish world. Now, this is 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. It's on Kdas Torah, what's going to happen. It's very fascinating to read in lieu of what has happened before our eyes in the Haredi world. Gentlemen, next week share with Miss for all the money in Fort Knox, all the gold, because next year she's the Rebbe in Berlin, and we'll deal with his relationship with Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. Ora, I know that upstairs, Stephanie is awaiting to see you.
Okay.
She asked me what time does Shia begin, when will Stephanie be there. I said I imagine she'll see you after Shia, and I want to thank you all for your participation, and the Eivishter should give us strength and health. Remember, Tuesday night is a memorial for Rav Moshe Horowitz, a man who deserves a lot of credit for changing the course of Anglo-Torah history. And yours truly is very much in debt to him because he called me in 69 and asked me to start teaching in Israel. And I remember I was working full-time for the encyclopedia, and 2 years later when the encyclopedia ends, they offered me a fortune of money to stay on in Keter as a staff editor, but I chose to be an impoverished individual, but to be spiritually a multi-millionaire. And I thank Reb Moshe Horowitz. Until we meet again, in health and happiness, das vadanya. I wanted to give a copy of the, I wanted to give this to V'Hester. You know, who comes from Boston. I'll tell you his name, 1 second. I'll tell you his name. Jay Solomon. but he's not here. Does anyone see Jay Solomon?
I see him every so often.
Do me a favor, give him the copy and tell him I'm paying him back for the copy of the wedding invitation that he let me copy after he paid $900 for it. The mansion let it out of his hands, gave it to me, and enabled me to copy it. If you notice, I'm using a new microphone, but a very good microphone that I had in my microphone supply kit. The one that I've used for so many decades, that one that you saw yesterday and so many times was fixed and schmixed and bixed, but I think it's gone forever now. I only have it since the mid-1950s. So I would say I got use out of it. It was a Philips. When they built things in the 50s, they built it properly. Today, if you saw Yediyot Achronot, Friday had a whole article in the money section. What does it pay to fix when it breaks down? When your Frigidaire breaks down, your washing machine, and it gives you an inner description. This thing breaks, you don't fix it. This thing breaks, you do fix it. And I was very impressed. They cite as their source some research, and in English, in the article, Consumers Report. Kol hakavod to Yediyot Achronot. At least on that level. Okay.
Is that your invitation?
Do you have the original then?
No. You can give that. You can give that away.
Do you have the original?
No, I don't have the original. This surfaced. Who saved that? I mean, you know, who would know? You follow me? Well, another wedding. But no, that's not my original. That has surfaced now. Someone held on to it. And today, 55 years later, it's a collector's item. Wow. Okay, stop. Bruchim to you. Bruchim to you. Start Berlin. You can take it. You can enjoy it. Aryeh Deri. I know him. I have to admit. I know many of the players here. Some wanted to give me jobs, but I always kept away.
I just saw the thing. They're planning another demonstration in Jerusalem tomorrow, so it might affect traffic.
Oh, my God. For the Ethiopians?
Yeah.
They don't stop.